Ready for a career in behavioral health? Earn your online degree at Herzing University. Choose from health and human services, psychology, or social work programs. Gain the skills to work, coordinate, and manage nonprofits. Secure a bachelor's in psychology to study mental health or advance your social work career through our online Masters of Social Work. Let us help you become a social change agent. Your future starts now at Herzing University. Text HEALTH to 85109. That's HEALTH to 85109. Or visit herzing.edu.
Hello, everyone. So we recorded this episode and then a bunch of stuff happened, namely the protests for justice for George Floyd have escalated and become even more prominent and now have become, thankfully and wonderfully, about complete police brutality reform and also, in my mind, abolition, which I'm very excited for because I think the momentum from all of this is, I mean, it's ringing similar to me to what happened in the civil rights era. I feel like there's a lot of hope for like massive change, which is wonderful. Mm-hmm. And
they're marching on Washington in August.
Incredible. And also the way that everyone has mobilized in support of Black Lives Matter has been so just historic. And obviously having social media and being able to see the ways in which the media is lying to us about what's happening, mm-hmm. the ways in which, you know, for example, the Buffalo PD yesterday released a statement saying that an elderly man had tripped and fallen. But luckily, we had video evidence that police had shoved him and then left him there.
While so he was bleeding from his head.
Yes. So I'm very... I mean, usually I'm so pessimistic. I'm very optimistic about people being able to actually see what goes on in police departments and how corrupt and racist that they are. So we wanted to hop on and obviously show our complete support with Black Lives Matter. And also, I have some resources I want to talk about. So there is a group called MPD 150, which has there's this building a police police-free future, frequently asked questions zine that's been going around that I've seen that's been really, really incredible to read. It's basically just about how do we abolish the police and how do we deal with crime and chaos and what are the alternatives to traditional policing, which I'm very into. And then there's also Black Visions Collective, which has been doing a lot. There's also just generally Black Lives Matter. There's also, we'll put in the show notes, some bailout funds. Mm-hmm. There's been tons of bailout funds for protesters. And I would encourage anyone who is only getting their news from the TV news to hop over onto social media.
Yeah, Twitter is doing a really good job of mm-hmm. archiving all of the incidences of police brutality and making mm-hmm. it easy and sharing like the correct information. And mm-hmm. I find that that's the stuff you need to send to your friends and family who just aren't getting it.
Yes. You know, I think if you have privilege, there is such a scary idea in terms of changing everything about the way that policing or the justice system works. However, I think nothing has been won without a hard fight. And, you know, at a certain point, abolishing slavery seemed wildly great, like, oh my God, we could never do it. And so I just encourage you to think bigger and to think more about the collectiveness of what needs to change.
And I think if you look into what it actually means when people say defund the police and
correct.
How the police are being asked to do far too much with little to no training
correct.
And how so much of what they're asked to do should actually be done by social workers.
Not even social workers. Yes, social workers, but they're also mental health professionals. And I mean, look into MPD 150. That's been great. There's also in Los Angeles, and I'm sure there's this for other places, the People's Budget, mm-hmm. which is millions or whatever dollars that go into the police department, what they actually could be used for. And so I just think, you know, there's a lot of momentum in terms of like real huge change. And I would encourage you to dream big about it because I think there's two minds that I've been seeing. I've been seeing some people who are very into incremental change. And I've seen some people who are happy to have this movement be for, you know, total defunding and abolition of the police.
There's also a difference between defunding where you
Yes, correct.
Reduce their budget versus abolition. So educate right. yourself and see what feels right to you.
Obviously, we want justice for George Floyd. There's also, you know, the cops who murdered Breonna Taylor are were not charged with anything. Mm-hmm. There's tons of other. It's not just about one black person. There's, you know, 601 people were killed by the LAPD in the I'm not sure what time frame, but that's too many people. So just make sure that you're not, you know, focusing on looting, or you're not concerned more about buildings than about people. And we'll put more resources in the show notes. And yeah, thus ends our update to this episode, correct?
And just also letting you guys know that when we recorded this episode, things were not where they are now. And therefore, that's why we're talking about, you know, just to give you a point of view of where we were coming from when we recorded it, and how now, oh man, defund the like things have changed, and we would have been much more aggressive had things have happened then. Do you know what I mean?
No, I think we were very focused on Trump, which right. let's not focus on Trump.
Right.
he did just put something forward to try to stop same-sex couples from adopting. So he's out there doing stuff. you know, he did tear gas a bunch of protesters so he could take a picture with a Bible. So let's not ignore him. But no. Yeah.
And we wanted to take the time to acknowledge what's going on, and yes. to acknowledge the pain everyone is feeling, and to provide some resources in our show description.
Yes.
And to stay safe, but also keep fighting and keep yes. believing that change is possible.
And that obviously, I mean, this show, me and Allison are 100% Black Lives Matter on the side of the protesters. Do like mm-hmm. no equivocation whatsoever. That's where
in case
we stand.
That wasn't clear from our other 60 yeah. episodes.
Sure, but I think it's important to say that, like, hi, we
this support you
100%. Mm-hmm. So okay, great, we did it.
Enjoy the show.
Just between us.
Hey.
Hello! I'm Allison Raskin. I'm a writer, director, and weightlifter, if you count 5-pound dumbbells.
I count them.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Gabby Dunn. I'm a writer, bicon, bisexual icon, wink, and oh gosh, unprepared. Oh, I should have saved that. But yeah, let's use unprepared.
Saved it for what?
Like another time when I'll probably be unprepared.
Well, you wasted it. You can't use it again.
Yeah, I guess not. I wish people... Here's the thing. An avid listener, will you write down all the things we've said and then send it to us so we know what we've said?
I've thought about going back and doing that, and then I thought, too much work.
Yeah, let a fan do it.
We'll pay you $5.
I'll pay you $5. I was like, why do I, what am I, that, I got nothing to lose. I'll pay you $5 to do it.
This is Just Between Us, a variety show filled with heartfelt advice.
Oh, ridiculous games.
And brutal honesty. I'm keeping with this unprepared theme today.
I'm fully asleep. No, I just like, I mean, I know that we try not to like date these, but my brain has been exploded. So like, as we're recording this today, is like all the protests in Minneapolis, and it's like very hard to concentrate. I mean, it's interesting to hop on this platform and try to make it evergreen, but also be like, I mean, this is evergreen, right? Like, this type of thing happens all the time. What we're talking about is the protests regarding George Floyd. And obviously, I think Allison and I both agree Black Lives Matter, and we're like on the side of the protesters. But yeah, it's like, it's fun. It's weird to be like, I could say this now and then we'll be like, oh, it won't be. It'll be relevant. Like,
yeah.
It'll be relevant. So
it's been relevant and it continues to be relevant. I think we have a good guest for that.
So our guest this week is John Lovett of the Love It and Leave It podcast, and also a speechwriter and just like political aficionado. And we're going to talk about the power of language in terms of like political speeches and how do you persuade? How do you turn the tide? How do you comfort a nation? And I think like that's something that is incredibly relevant now, considering
we're
a president who can't do it. Yeah, exactly. So I'm glad that that's our guest today.
And later, we'll be discussing exposure therapy.
Allison is an expert.
But first, hit it! International question! International question! International question! Gia, Canada.
Some really good names lately. Gia is a very sexy name.
Ooh, okay. What if she's underage, Gabby?
I didn't say she was sexy. I just said her name is sexy.
So Gia asks, should a relationship be easy? I'm in a 4-year relationship that is, for the most part, great. We have a lot in common. We have similar goals for the future and we have a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. However, every once in a while, our communication breaks down. I'm much more sensitive and emotionally needy person, while he is very pragmatic and has difficulty expressing how he feels. So a few times a year, we'll have a big, exhausting fight that stems from this root issue. My concern is that even though we are compatible in 9 out of 10 categories, that this incompatibility is something we can't really change. We both try to make an effort in bridging this gap, but at the end of the day, I don't know if it will ever go away. So I guess my question is, should my relationship be easier than this? I've often heard that a good relationship should be easy. Is this a realistic issue to overcome? And if it never properly goes away, is it worth staying in a relationship that isn't always smooth sailing?
Well, I mean, it sounds like it's usually smooth sailing. Like, it sounds like only having these big fights, like, you know, once or twice a year doesn't seem that bad to me. I mean, I've been in relationships where we didn't fight at all, and that was terrible because that showed that we weren't really communicating or there wasn't real. It was like very like a friendship.
Well, I would say that I think that there are going to be struggles and there are going to be hard times, but fighting is different. So I think that you can disagree, but it sounds like these are kind of somewhat explosive. And I think the fact that it's the same issue over and over and over again is a problem.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, communication is a huge thing, but you don't have to do it alone. Like, I think, like, if communication seems to be the main problem, why not see a couples therapist? Like, why not have a third person help you with the bridging the communication gap?
And I'm also curious, like, what the tone of those fights are, you know? So, like, the couple that lives above us is constantly screaming at each other and, like, throwing FUs and, like
yeah, so, it can't be like that.
Right. So, like, are those fights still respectful? Like, is it frustrating, but you're still treating each other with respect and love and care? Or are you, like, saying stuff that you wish you could take back and it, like, it becomes a huge explosion, you know? So
does it immediately become, like, a personal attack rather than, like, oh, you're not understanding me? Does it go from you're not understanding me to fuck you forever?
Right.
Yeah.
So I think a lot of it depends on, like, how you're communicating to each other in those fights.
True.
So if you have, like, an unhealthy fighting style, then the fact that you're having a couple of explosive fights a couple times a year is a big deal.
That's true.
Because that's really damaging. So I think
I was picturing like not that explosive of a fight.
Well, because, but it seems to be really bothering her.
Yeah, yeah. But I think also there's this depiction of relationships as needing to be perfect. There's two things. There's depictions of relationships as needing to be perfect, and then there's depictions of relationships where it's like it's fully abusive and they're like, this is romance. And I feel like there's never a depiction of like a couple in the middle. I think you have to figure out like the tone of the fights, but also I don't think it's fair to say like never fight.
No, I'm not saying that. I would say that like you're asking, should relationships be easy? But the real thing is life easy? And the answer is no. So you're going to have issues.
Yeah.
But I think what's important is that you remain on the same team.
Yes. Huge. Right. So that's why if you're working together to communicate effectively and the fights are just like, oh, we're not like on the same page. But if the fights are like, we are enemies.
Right.
And like, this person doesn't have my best interests and nobody is assuming good intentions. That's like a big part of my like fighting style or whatever with my partner, even though we fought maybe like 4 times. But the fighting style is like, is everyone assuming there are good intentions? Mm-hmm. Like, I'm never assuming that Mal is out to get me.
Right.
And like, Mal really kind of struggles with assuming that I have good intentions. So that's an interesting, like, I feel like the boyfriend where I, it's very hard for me to communicate like feelings. It's hard for me to respond to someone who is, Mal's a little bit needy. Mm-hmm. So it's like, as long as we both assume that things are coming from love, it's like very, like we want to work it out. Like every fight is like, not like we're going to break up. It's like, okay, how can we work this out? And if that's your like end goal of the fight, rather than how can I hurt this person or how can we break up, then like that's the fight.
And I think that like, again, this idea of like relationships should be easy. It's like, what are the issues in your life? You know, like if your issue in your life is your relationship, then that's not good. But right. If like, let's say someone's parent is terminally ill, mm-hmm. like that relationship for a bit is not going to be easy because one person is in like extreme pain and
true.
Like probably both people are. And that's a really mm-hmm. tough time in your life. And it's not going to be like smooth sailing. But mm-hmm. if you like remain on the same team and you like get through life's hardships together, mm-hmm. then that's what's important. But if mm-hmm. like, it's not easy because your two personalities are just constantly mm-hmm, mm-hmm. not getting along, then I think that that's not a great fit.
Yeah. And where is the fighting come from? Like with my ex, I felt like the fights popped up out of like she created them mm-hmm. versus like if something happens, like you said, like how does the fight start? Like look at how does it start? What is causing it? And then, you know, also to both of you, like at the end of the fight, you really should like have action items. Like you really should sit down and be like, what are we going to do differently?
And the one thing that is worrisome to me is that it seems like you guys keep repeating the same habits.
That's what I mean. Like, what are the action items? What are we going to change? What can we not do again? What boundary was crossed? Like, hey, I don't want you to bring up this thing. Okay. Like, you know what I mean? Like, what are the action items? Like, when I bring this up and I don't, and you don't want to talk about it, what will we do then? You know what mm-hmm. I mean? Like, just come up with like, what are we going to do differently?
Yeah. And have those conversations not during the fight.
No. After.
Yeah. Or even before, you know.
Yeah, like, a different time.
Right. After you hear this podcast, maybe sit him down and really go over stuff.
Yeah. Have like specific action items, like even just like what would make you feel good, or like what is the safe word for I don't want to talk right now, or something like that. Like very explicit.
I also think you have to be true to yourself. And if the idea of spending 50 years with this person and having the same fight mm-hmm. two or three times a year is fucking exhausting, mm-hmm. then, you know, like, obviously you're not going to be compatible about everything, but mm-hmm. you have to be compatible about the important things. And the important things are different to everyone. Yeah. So if for you, these fights are so emotionally draining and so triggering and so traumatic, then that's a big deal. So even if you're 9 out of 10, that mm-hmm. that 1% is important versus yes. other people who kind of bounce back from fights faster. It's not that big of a deal. So that incompatibility wouldn't matter as much to them.
Yes. And communication styles can evolve and you can get on the same page and you can like have a therapy session where you like figure it out, or like you can adjust communication style. So you saying like, well, it'll never change. Like, that's not true. Like people grow and adapt and learn what other people need. And, you know, it's been 4 years. So I feel like you guys should maybe be further along in that. But yeah, I mean, I think relationships should be fun. You know what I mean? Like easy is like an interesting word. Like, I think you should be having fun. I don't think it should be all work. I don't think it should be like we're working on this, you know, constantly, like, and not having any fun and not like actually enjoying each other. Like, it's that thing of like, who was I talking to where it was like, maybe it was for Scam Goddess, but it was like, why do you date people that you clearly hate? Mm-hmm. Like, why are you with someone if you like don't enjoy being around them? Right. And you're not having fun? So like easy in my head went to like, is the relationship fun and worthwhile? And like, you're actually having a good time also.
I mean, the person needs to primarily bring you joy and support.
Joy,
and
yeah.
And if that's not the case, then it's going to be a lot tougher. And again, going back to life is tough. So this is an area of your life that you don't want, that you want to get strength from, mm-hmm. not have to also work on all the time.
I also feel like in my past relationships, when I've been arguing with someone I'm dating and I feel as though it's wasting my time, like, then I would rather be single. Like, mm-hmm. if it's like, oh my God, I'm spending so much time in these like hours long fights with this person, and like, and this is just me, Gabby, and I could have written a novel in that time. Like, you know, is the relationship serving you and lifting you up, or is it like eating you alive, draining your emotions and wasting your time?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, with Jake, it's like, it feels definitely easier than any other relationship. And, mm-hmm. you know, I think I've really come to accept that I do a lot better with someone who's much more like me than the opposite of me. I think mm-hmm. like this idea of like opposites attract really did not work for me and made my relationships much harder.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, you know, Mal and I have been separated during this pandemic, although they are moving here. But that that has been like tough. And that's the thing that you're saying of like the outside world. Like Mal was like, we like fought yesterday. And I'm like, yeah, tensions are high. Mm-hmm. Like it has nothing to do with us. Like we are living through like civil unrest, like a medical emergency. Like, you know, nobody's going to be in the greatest mood.
But again, how do you treat each other in the hard exactly. times? That's exactly. what's important.
Yes. And so like, if something sparks, it's sort of like, well, okay, but like before all of this, everything was fine. So if it's like
no, Allison, but I would say if you have a bad fight and the way that you treat each other is poor in that fight, it doesn't
course.
Matter if the other stuff is good.
Yes,
you have to maintain a level of like respect and courtesy towards your partner always.
This is what I'm saying. And so we don't do that. You have to acknowledge what's going on outside. So it's like not like I suck or Mal sucks. It's like we'll be like, oh man, yeah, sorry, like, you know, pandemic. Like you have to be aware that like it's not like of what else is going on in the context of the fights and stuff. And mm-hmm. and like the context of, but like if there isn't a context and they just kind of spring out of nowhere, like it was with my ex, that's like, that's whiplash. I was constantly confused. I was like being drained. Like I didn't understand why I was in trouble.
Yeah.
Like I think like it was just like not sustainable because it wasn't coming from a place of trying to work together and be partners.
Right. Well, we hope that helped. Let us know if you break up. If you want to submit your international question, send it to justbetweenuspod@gmail.com. That's justbetweenuspod@gmail.com.
Up next, we've got a juicy interview with our highly esteemed guest, John Lovett. Stay tuned. Stay tuned?
Yeah, stay tuned.
Stay attuned.
Ooh,
I'm here. Just between
us. Hey! With Mother's Day around the corner, are you thinking about a truly special gift for your mom? Let me tell you all about MyLifeInABook.com. It's a unique service that turns your mom's life stories into a beautiful book. Pretty cool, right? Here's how it works. Every week, MyLifeInABook.com will send her a question via email. These can be pre-written questions about her life or any custom questions you wish to ask. And then she can either type her response or use their voice-to-text feature. And MyLifeInABook.com compiles all her responses into a beautiful keepsake book. And guess what? They can even create an audiobook using her voice recordings. It's like preserving her voice and her stories for eternity. Imagine discovering stories about her youth, adventures, and the challenges she overcame. This book becomes a legacy, something you and future generations can treasure forever. Your mom's given you a lifetime of stories. This is your chance to give her a way to share them. Right before I found out about this project, my mom made an offhand comment about wanting to write a memoir because she had such a wild childhood and there are all these things she's never really talked to us about. But asking someone to sit down and write a memoir is kind of daunting. So then I got her MyLifeInABook.com, and now she's getting prompts to answer on a weekly basis, and it's a lot easier than just undertaking an entire memoir. I'm so excited to see what my mom does with MyLifeInABook.com because she's someone who doesn't always feel comfortable just sharing about herself, but having these prompts and knowing that I really want to hear her answers is going to inspire her to probably share more with me about her life and her upbringing than I've ever been shared with before. So I'm so excited for that. Check out MyLifeInABook.com and use code JUSTBETWEENUS at checkout for 10% off. Create an unforgettable gift for your mom this Mother's Day. That's MyLifeInABook.com. Use code JUSTBETWEENUS for 10% off today. Hi everyone, Allison here. Anyone who knows me well knows that I love to read. I am always looking for new books, and that is why I am so excited that this episode is sponsored by Book of the Month. Book of the Month's mission is to help readers discover new books they love and to promote the work of emerging authors. It was so fun for me to get to pick which book I wanted to read this month and have it shipped right to my door. Book of the Month makes it easy to decide which book to read next. Each month, the editorial team reads through hundreds of new titles. They pick some of the best new books for you to choose from. All the books are good, so you can't go wrong. Every aspect of the Book of the Month experience is designed to be fun and special for readers. They have a highly anticipated release at the beginning of each month. Books are delivered in this really adorable bright blue box, and there's a fun app to help you pick your book and track your reading process. They also offer great values on new release hardcover fiction. It's much cheaper than other options. Shipping is always free, and with a loyalty program, you get rewards and even lower prices the longer you stay as a member. My first book from Book of the Month was The Husbands by Holly Gramazio. I am tearing through this book. It is so fun. It's basically about this woman who one day comes home and there's a husband in her apartment, and she's like, "Where did you come from?" And then she figures out that every time her new husband goes into the attic, a new husband comes out, and she's like shuffling through all these different husbands from the attic trying to figure out which one is the best. It is right up my alley, and I love it so much. So if you want to take part in Book of the Month and have a brand new book shipped right to your door every single month, go to bookofthemonth.com and get your first book for $5 with code PETALS. That's $5 off with code PETALS. I cannot recommend this enough. Welcome back to Just Between Us. It's time for the juiciest, most scandalous, controversial segment known to all of podcasting, Tough Questions.
Our guest this week is former presidential speechwriter and host of Love It or Leave It and of Pod Save America, John Lovett. Hi.
Hi. That was such a dramatic introduction. I did not know what I was in
for. Yeah, we are prone to hyperbole mm-hmm. here on this show.
I don't know. This could be the toughest questions we've ever asked.
That's true. Yeah, we don't know.
We don't know. I don't know, certainly. You should know. I don't know.
It's too soon.
It's too soon.
Yeah. You do so much across the board, especially in the podcasting world, but we actually wanted to kind of dive into what it was like to be a speechwriter, because as we know, I don't know who's writing Trump's speeches, but yeah. Anyone.
It's sort of a group effort in a 4chan message board.
That makes sense. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But what compelled you to become a speechwriter?
I liked politics. I was interested in politics. You know, I was a closeted gay kid growing up. And I think politics was a place where you could basically give voice to your, you know, it was a place to give voice to a feeling of being marginalized that I wasn't able to actually talk about. So I was able to sort of use politics as a way to express myself as something sort of adjacent to what I was actually feeling. And then, you know, I just was drawn to it because I watched The West Wing in high school. I thought of presidential speechwriting as this special, rarefied thing, and I wanted to try it. I just sort of felt like I could contribute something there. And so, you know, I wrote op-eds in my college newspaper. I volunteered on campaigns and was lucky enough to get the chance to do it. I guess I felt like it was suited to my ability to yell and rant and talk about politics, which would come in handy later, but was somewhat useful in the speechwriting phase, I guess.
I just watched the Trump press conference that was unhelpful in its entirety just now. And so, like, ideally, in times of crisis, like, what makes, like, a good speech?
So you immediately want to make it all about yourself and the kind of grievances that you're feeling, no matter how small they are compared to what other people are going to. You want to be the center of every controversy. And then you want to find the kind of fissures, the deepest cracks in our society, the broken places. You want to find the places where there might be air bubbles inside of the vase that is American culture. Mm-hmm. And then you want to turn the heat up. You want to really see what happens if you can get those bubbles to burst, to see if via your word you can make the entire vase, again, a metaphor for our society, to fall apart. You know, it's the real answer, obviously, is we've gone too far before Trump in kind of vesting in this person of the president these important leadership roles beyond the purview of what's in the job in the Constitution. You know, this is America. This is not supposed to be a ruler. And so I've always been a little bit uncomfortable with how much our culture now, because of the nationalization of the news, looks to the president to be the be-all and end-all of important moments. That said, there is a really important role for the president to play in speaking to people's fears and anxieties, channeling people's fears and anxieties into a healthy direction, channeling people's hopes for the country into a productive direction. You know, at a moment like this, I think, you know, there's, you know, this, you know, Trump does things that are wrong, but there's also a ton of things that are missing that a better person would do right. You know, Trump won't wear a mask. A president would not just be wearing a mask right now. They'd be thinking really hard with a bunch of advisors, like, how can we really make sure that everybody understands the importance of masks? Let's do a video where we get Tom Hanks and LeBron and Oprah and Meryl Streep and, you know, Dua Lipa to put on masks. And we're not doing it without her.
Right. It obviously has to include Dua Lipa.
A dual breaker. I'm sorry.
Yeah. If you want the gays involved in any way, it must include Dua Lipa.
That's the rule. That's the rule. Yeah. But but like organizing people around these better virtues. And the other piece of it too is like we're all like at home. You know, there are some people that have to work. And there's some people doing, whether it's, you know, grocery deliveries or working in a hospital or just taking on jobs that they have to do just to live. But there's also a lot of people at home doing their best to kind of, through inaction, what feels like inaction, like be supportive, like help people by being mm-hmm. being a fellow human being and staying home. And I don't care who you are. Like, I don't care how cynical you are. I don't care how much you think that you're above it. People want to be told, like, hey, I see you doing that. And I'm grateful. You know, it's a really nice thing that you're doing and it's really good. And it may feel like you're not doing something, but actually you're actually by staying home, even though it feels like an action, you're helping a lot of people. Thank you. And Trump incites violence all the time. And you know, they call, you know, there's a term for it, right? Like stochastic terrorism. It's a silly term, but it just means no one person, he's not actually responsible for any specific act, but he's encouraging things to go wrong. And if you put enough mm-hmm. filth into the world, somebody's going to grab onto it and randomly use it as a justification. And we see that with coronavirus. You know, he, by being against masks and by insulting masks and all the rest, like, is he responsible for any one person's decision? No, but collectively he's hurting us by encouraging mm-hmm. so many people not to participate. Anyway.
No, yeah, so that's what I want to talk about, because like the power of words coming from a specific person. I mean, do you think anybody is writing what he's saying? Do you think that there's like anyone who's aware of the power of the speech, you know?
Two different questions, I guess.
Two different questions.
No, I'm thinking about it. I mean, look, he has speechwriters. He has C+N, Monica Fascist, Stephen Miller writing speeches. I think there are others that are writing speeches. Do any of them understand what the job of being president really is? Either they understand it and can't get him to do it, or they don't understand it, or they don't care. But, you know, White Houses reflect the person at the top. The White House has had an incredible amount of turnover. New chiefs of staff, new writers, new communications directors, new press secretaries. And through it all, the tone and tenor that has come from this building is identical. And the reason it is because it all flows from him. I don't care if you have the greatest speechwriter on earth in that building. It wouldn't matter because maybe the sentences would be more beautifully structured and that'd be an improvement. But it's the sentiment would be the same.
Mm-hmm. I feel like in the past, like these presidential speeches were pretty much the only time when the president would be like directly, you know, addressing America. And now with the addition of social media, they can like address America 100 times a day. So when you were a speechwriter, like what was the line there? Like how much did you guys rely on like Twitter and social media, and how much did you try to kind of like separate him as someone who is more presidential and more just speaking on like major platforms?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I think when I was a speechwriter in the White House, that's 2009, 2010, 2011. And it's sort of the beginning of figuring out how mm-hmm. social media is used and who would have accounts and who wouldn't have accounts. And are they personal mm-hmm. accounts? Are they professional accounts? Are they archived? Like who's in, like, so they were sorting those kinds of things out at the time. But the general direction, I think, has been clear for a while, which is as the media has become more fractured and there are fewer platforms that reach everybody. Being a, the bully pulpit, like the president's ability to reach millions and millions of people at once, has become more about kind of casting a wide net and doing the major networks, but also looking for opportunities to get around that and get your message out directly. That's ads, that's videos on Facebook, that's tweets, that's speaking to, you know, podcasts, whatever it may be. But the going around the traditional media and trying to get to people directly has been a trend for a while. I remember Karl Rove and George W. Bush, like their campaign being so proud of the fact that he was doing interviews with fishing magazines because it was a way to speak directly to people through the medium of fishing magazines.
Sure.
Imagine reading a fishing magazine.
It probably would be a good place to start. I mean, we're putting it down, but there's probably a lot of insights in there for someone like me because I don't know. I don't have a rod and a reel.
That's
you know,
true.
I have no tackle box.
So, okay, I have a question about choosing words. Like, so if you're writing a speech and you're choosing how to frame something, right? So like, for example, Trump saying Wuhan virus or China virus or the use of the word thugs to describe the protesters. When you're writing speeches, like, how important is it to be like, okay, how am I going to exactly phrase this? And like, it might seem obvious, but like, what does it mean to choose those words, you know?
So there, I feel like there's two things going on with Trump and this stuff. One is he's just obviously doesn't care, you know, he's trying to incite racial animus and he's doing it willingly. I mean, you go look and there's the statement he made about the anti-mask and anti-shutdown protesters, the mostly white people carrying assault rifles and intimidating people in Michigan and elsewhere. And it's like, these are good people. Just tell them you love them, give them a hug and a cookie, and please send them home. They're just fine, ordinary Americans standing up for their rights. And then, of course, this is thugs, you know, and you know, he talks about, you know, looting and shooting and what have you. So there's that just comes from him, and it's morally reprehensible. But part of what's also broken down is, you know, when I was a speechwriter in the White House, these were really involved processes. So, like, you would write a speech, even when tweeting was taking off, it would obviously have less scrutiny than a big speech. But still, like, take a speech. You know, you would either potentially you would meet with the president or you'd meet with advisors, and when you'd gather information and tons of research, a bunch of people would give you the policies you needed to talk about. The researchers would send you ideas for stories you could tell and past speeches. You'd gather all that information, you'd do a draft, and then you would send it to 50 people. You would meet with, at the time, it was David Axelrod, the president's senior advisor, and he would talk through the emotions you're trying to convey, and he would think out loud about the best way to talk about these really difficult issues. At the time, mostly, you know, we were, you know, for me, mostly I was working on speeches around the economic crisis. How do you talk about the economic crisis and the steps you're taking to improve people's lives without overstating it and recognizing the pain people still feel? What's the best language to do that that doesn't anger anybody, that strikes the right note of realism and optimism? All those delicate conversations. Then 50 people are weighing in on the facts and checking every line. Like, I remember I worked on a speech about scientific discovery and policy. And in it, I had said that on this mission, I'm going to get it wrong, but it was, let's say it's Apollo 8, and it's the capsule is orbiting the moon. And I said, on the seventh rotation, X happened. And the researcher fact checker looked at it and said, I think that was the seventh and a half rotation. So can you please make it over right. seven rotations? Because it's not technically seven rotations. And obviously there are mistakes and you get things wrong, or there's blind spots and you just miss, like, hey, this is going to be misinterpreted. This sounds too simple. We know what you meant, but in time, this will look like you are being deceitful in some way or whatever. These, you know, controversies are natural. But that's the care that went into this work, right? Like, real serious care. And that's gone. That's completely gone. There's nobody with the competence or interest in being that careful around Donald Trump, because the only kind of people that'll work for Donald Trump are the kind of people that'll work for Donald Trump. And so that's why there are more errors. That's why there's so much chaos, because there's just no management. There's no, on top of the racism, on top of the malevolence, there's all this incompetence.
Do you think that there's a chance for us, if we take back the presidency and the Senate, and to reclaim the power of the truth? Or do you think that now that there's just so much false information through social media and the internet, it'll be an uphill battle?
It's such a hard question. And I don't think I have I feel like your answers and thoughts are just as valid. What I'm getting at is only that I think it's a problem that collectively, like, we all have to grapple with. We're all experts in social media. I don't think anyone's experience in politics before this era is going to help you understand how to fight back against what we're seeing right now. I interviewed these two professors who wrote a book called Many People Are Saying, and it was a look at how conspiracy theories are changing. And one of the things that's so striking is, all right, you look at like 9/11 conspiracies, and there's all kinds of facts about this argument, and it's obviously steel doesn't melt at this. You can't melt steel at this temperature. This doesn't make sense. Mm-hmm. This plane wasn't there. Look at the footage of Building 7. It's people, I think, desperate to find an explanation that comports with their anxiety, that sort of makes sense of the world. Like, this couldn't have just been a group of random people. This had to be something orchestrated by our own government, right? Like, there has to be a deeper explanation because the world needs to make sense. And there's a desire to make sense of the world through conspiracy theories. And so this elaborate fact case is put together and it results in 9/11 truthers. But what Trump does, what's more prevalent now, is a new kind of conspiracism, which is a conspiracy without the theory. He just says Obamagate and he leaves it to others to fill in the details, or, rigged. Right. And you leave it to others to fill in the details. And then there are these entrepreneurial people like, Alex Jones, or politicians like Tom Cotton, who grab onto it, the Wuhan virus. It was this, whatever it is. They grab onto it. And then this whole industry fills in the details until it gets to the bottom. So what used to be ground up is now top down. And I think how we figure this out in a world where nothing goes away and lives forever on Twitter is really, really hard. And beyond that, I just don't know. I just think it's about everybody being vigilant. And also, like, the goal is disorientation. And so just the collective act of saying to each other, we're not crazy, there is a common reality. All I guess I'd say is that it's all very disorientating. It's designed to do that. Our job is to kind of push back continuously, not be exhausted, and remind each other that there is a common reality and we are describing it. Mm-hmm. We are being gaslit. We are being fed misinformation, and that is meant to stop us from participating. It's meant to tell a whole bunch of people that they can't know what's true, and it's meant to turn a whole other group of people off and pretend that politics doesn't exist, and that's how they win, and that's not how we win. We got to fight back against that. That's all.
Yeah, I mean, it's not just social media. It's coming directly from the president's mouth. So I feel like even if there wasn't the ability for him to be on Twitter, he would be doing the same stuff in like a fireside chat situation too. And luckily, like, you're right, that I had never thought of it as top down now rather than down up.
Yeah. And yeah, look, I think Twitter should enforce its rules. Like, they're not even holding Trump to a higher standard or our standard. They hold Trump to a lower standard. Like, if there's a set of rules, just apply it. And the problem is they tie themselves in knots. They really screw themselves, because now applying their basic standards that they do to everybody looks like some kind of political act. Like, if they had just applied their rules from the very beginning, we wouldn't be in this mess. But the idea that, like, Trump won't have a vehicle to spread his filth, like, he could just send a press release with the words he would have tweeted, and that will immediately be screenshotted and shared infinitely on Twitter.
Oh my God.
He accused Joe Scarborough of murder on Twitter, but he also did it in an interview. Kellyanne Conway went to the White House lawn this week and threatened a Twitter executive, not even like a top guy, like a mid-level executive by name, to direct a bunch of hate at that person. Like, these people do not need Twitter to be evil. It helps them. Mm-hmm. It does. But they have workarounds.
Yeah.
Do you think that there's the possibility of, like, restoring at least like the respect that the presidency of the United States used to have through having a candidate or a president who is able to reclaim words and speeches and speak, and like kind of have that
comfort the people
Obama had?
Give the people like words that will, comfort them or at least make people feel safe.
Yeah.
Our typical idea of what presidential used to be.
Let's say we can get to a place where Trump is gone. We've successfully defeated Trump. We've removed him from office. There will be an extraordinary effort to erase the culpability of Republicans. It will begin instantly. It'll begin before he's gone. On top of that, there will be a desire to move on. And there will be an argument made by, I think, well-meaning people that says, do you want to be right or do you want to win? because there's going to be polling that says, what's more important to you, right? Like, do you want us to focus on the mistakes and errors that and injustices of Trump's administration? Or do you want to move forward and try to, whatever the kind of misleading questions may be, but right. There's just going to be this incredible pressure to move forward. I mean, that's what, like, and you look at, like, our recent history, you know, Gerald Ford pardons Nixon, the Iran-Contra pardons, Trump's pardons, you know, them trying to get Flynn off the hook, like, again and again and again. I mean, even in the, you know, Obama era, the desire to move past the crimes of the Bush administration to right. move forward is incredibly, it's incredibly powerful. And so we are not particularly good at looking backwards for accountability, but I do think that that's going to be really important and something we're going to have to fight for, even though there's going to be a lot of good arguments not to do it. I mean, but again, like, that's a position I just, what a privileged place that will be if we can be talking about how to hold those who capitulated to Trump accountable once he's gone. Mm-hmm. But you know, like, look, to your question, yeah, I mean, I think America is good at forgetting. So, you know, once we can have somebody in there that speaks with just like a modicum of respect for human beings and empathy, and, mm-hmm. and Joe Biden, you don't have to love him, but you can see that this is a person that has kind of rooted his politics in loss and understands how to relate to people who have been through trauma. And this is a country that has been through trauma, and there's value in that.
Yeah, I just keep thinking, like, now, especially, like someone, not necessarily Obama, but like someone could be speaking to people and calming all of this down. Someone at the top could be giving some kind of address that would, you know, stop all the violence instead of inciting. Like, it's just so important. I think we never really realized how important, like, the way that the president speaks to the people is until all of a sudden we didn't have it.
Yeah,
we didn't have the normal.
I think that's right.
How important do you think that the vice president pick is? Because I know once they hit office, like, it's kind of dull, but the campaigning and, like, their speeches and how
their
they
messaging.
Speak to the people,
yeah.
Do you think that that's really going to be important?
It's a really good question. I think it's never been more important than this pick because Joe Biden is older and has signaled that he may not pursue a second term. And he's talked openly about mm-hmm. the fact that he views his presidency as a bridge to a new generation. So I think that that is a recognition that Biden sees his running as a means of getting rid of Trump and getting the country back to some stable, safe ground from which to make progress. But that may very well fall on the shoulders of whoever Biden picks, and whoever she is going to immediately be seen as a likely nominee, or at least one of the likely nominees in 2024 if we were to win. So I think that makes the pick more important than in the past. That said, is it ever important? It seems like you can really blow it, right? Picking Sarah Palin was a huge mistake once it was exposed that she thought being asked if she read a magazine was a gotcha question.
Gosh, were we ever so young? I just thought of that.
She was.
Wow.
I mean, think about it. Sarah Palin, you know, in Jurassic Park, when there's like a dinosaur will crest the hill and they'll be like, wait, oh, there's a dinosaur. Mm-hmm. That's a little bit scary. And then you realize it's just the first dinosaur and that it's actually a herd of dinosaurs.
Yep.
She was the first dinosaur over the hill and we just didn't get running fast enough.
Yeah.
That's a beautiful, terrifying metaphor.
I mean, it's also crazy because they're not particular, like, she's not a particularly good speaker. Like, Trump's not a particularly good speaker. Like, in my mind, I'm so like, what are they hitting on for these people, these rallies? Like,
I feel like, you know, Palin is not good off the cuff, but like, I forget sometimes, like, she, that first day when she gave that speech at the convention, like, she was charismatic, that whole thing about lipstick on a pig. She had she had a moment where everyone was like, oh, she's scary. She's really talented. And, you know, she had a fork in the road, right? Like, she had a moment where she could have chosen, like, am I going to, like, hunker down? Like, I think she's a really smart, ambitious person. Like, she had a moment where she really could have decided, like, I'm going to become a serious politician, but it was much easier to become what she became. Like, it's easier,
like,
to
famous
yeah. reality,
yeah.
Kind of a right wing pundit personality. Yeah, that was the path she chose. And then I think Trump just is very much in that path. And I think it's hard for us to see Trump as anything other than a monster because it's what he is. but he's charismatic. He's charismatic, and he has conviction even when he's lying. I mean, that's why those Sarah Cooper videos are so funny. It's because her eyes show what it would be like if somebody actually admitted to the uncertainty and idiocy and ignorance that's propelling the words, right? Like, she has that, she does that, but he hides it. And so, you know, he's good at TV. He's charismatic. And it's the core of his appeal.
Yeah.
And it's a bummer.
It is. Cause it's so, you watch the videos of him speaking at rallies and it's like unhinged, but it's clearly resonating with these people. So it's just very confusing. Like, is it the sometimes I think it's like the repetition of him just like repeating these phrases that I think maybe works on people.
I think that's true. I also think sometimes it's not that complicated, like in the sense that like the base that goes to these events, these rallies, they love him. They eat it up because the racial grievance, the racism, the misogyny, the hearkening back to some bygone era that never existed makes them feel safe, makes them feel comfortable, right? These are people that feel disconnected from their country despite their incredible success and privilege. And Trump tells them they're a victim and it feels really good. Then there's everybody else. And there are lots of people that aren't Trump super fans, like the base that goes to these rallies, kind of the people that might have voted for Trump or voted for Hillary. They might come back to Biden. They might stick with Trump. They think he did a good job on the economy. They don't like the tweets. They don't care enough about racism. But
right.
that doesn't mean that they love his most heinous rhetoric, right? There are a fair amount of number of people like that. And, you know, sometimes I think it's just a really simple explanation. They don't see a problem with the kind of unhinged extremist rhetoric coming out of these rallies because nobody tells them about it. It's not in the stories. Mm. It's not like... just the act of imposing a narrative on a Trump rally is helpful to Trump. Like, Trump came to Michigan today and spoke about the importance of the economy and controlling the borders. Like, that is giving Trump a story that he really didn't tell. Really what he did is he got up for 2 hours, yelled, talked about how ugly some opponent of his was, reminisced about having sex on a boat in the 70s, talked about punching protesters, weaved in a heinous thing about immigrants, talked about how much he likes Mike Pence, then talked about how he shouldn't have picked Mike Pence. Like, just a rambling, incoherent right. two-hour thing, and then it's described in this cogent way. So that, to me, is part of the problem, too. Like, just the act of filtering his words helps him find a message.
Yeah. You said something that really struck with me is, like, that he makes them feel safe. And I feel like I've just been craving that, like how much I would crave to like see an announcement from a president whose rhetoric and demeanor and just like policies like make me feel safe and how much I crave that.
Yeah, and I think it's really sad. It's really sad to feel like this person is meant to represent us and of course doesn't and can't and doesn't care. And I do think, like, you know, I think sometimes people, especially on Twitter, like they yell at the New York Times, they yell at the media. I do it myself. And actually, even people being like, oh, what if Trump doesn't leave? What if he doesn't leave? And really, I think what people are saying is, in some way, not, oh, I can't believe Trump is doing this. It's more, why doesn't everyone understand how wrong this is? Why is this close? There's this great Norm Macdonald joke, which is Germany declared war on the whole world, and you wouldn't believe it. It was close. And it's like, why is this fucking close? Like, Trump at 40% is a crisis, right? This monster appealing to this many people is a crisis. How much did we not understand just how broken this country was that someone like this could get close, let alone win? So that, to me, I think is part of the pain. It's the feeling like you don't know your country.
Well, would you like to play a game show?
Sure. No, let's keep talking about the most depressing political era.
Yeah.
You know, we got to remember we're all more resilient than we think.
Yeah, for sure. For sure.
And John's used to abrupt tonal shifts.
Absolutely.
I think, from Love It or Leave It.
You bet.
So this game is called Hypotheticals. You and Gabby are my contestants. I'm going to give you a series of hypothetical situations. You can ask as many questions as you want, and then you have to tell me what you would do in that scenario. And then, much like Trump, I will arbitrarily decide if I love it or hate it and want you thrown in jail.
Okay.
Yeah, and we are against each other.
Got it.
So we're opposite each other.
I'm so ready.
Okay.
Let me tuck my new hair. I have to tuck my I didn't have to used to do this, but now I have to tuck my hair behind my ears.
It's
the
beautiful.
Quarantine look.
Yeah.
Okay, so our first game is America's favorite game show. Would you stay with this cheater?
Okay.
Your partner of 16 years is accused of cheating on you in a best-selling memoir written by their ex. Your partner denies it. Would you stay with this accused cheater? Everyone, including Oprah, thinks the book is true.
Oh, my God.
Wow.
Okay, wait. Wow. Okay, so we've been together for 16 years.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Are they still friendly with the ex who wrote the book?
They've kept in touch.
Is this the ex's first book?
They are a personality and they've done like op-eds and stuff, but this is their first full book.
What is the book about?
It's like it's a memoir about their life, and a big part of it is having this ongoing affair with your partner.
Now, let me ask you this. Is the partner more famous than the author?
Ooh.
Yes.
Wow. So the author is drafting a little bit off of my partner's fame. This is getting specific.
Mm-hmm.
Wait. The person in the book is saying that they cheated? I thought it was like that they were saying, oh, this ex of mine cheated on their partner. I didn't realize that they're saying they were sleeping with the ex.
Yes. That's why it's so scandalous.
And how, wow. And can you tell us a little bit more about the denial that we're getting? Because, like, that's important. Sure. I need to understand how it was denied.
They basically were like, ugh, I can't believe that they did this. Of course they would do this. They are still not over us having broken up and me picking you. They're just trying to get more publicity. But thank God that you trust me in our relationship and know that it's not true.
And did they release like a press release being like, I have never cheated on Gabby. This is a lie?
Yes, but everyone thinks that they're lying, including Oprah.
Okay. Is there any evidence beyond simply the two parties disagreeing for one version of reality or the other? Are there any receipts, any restaurants out, any hotel, any hotel dalliances?
Your partner was spotted going into the author's hotel room, but they deny that anything sexual happened.
What is the reason for the hotel visit?
They remained friends and, you know, the author was in town and they, you know, went to hang out.
Now, let me ask you a question. Is there any world in which I could spin this and be like, I can't believe I was cheated on. I'm the victim. Now everyone loves me. I'm like,
of course, but then you lose your partner.
Can I Jennifer Aniston this into like...
If you choose that path, but then your partner will leave you, or you will leave your partner.
That's fine. But like, am I more famous and I get like more press and stuff?
Everyone just thinks that you're an idiot for not knowing what was going on.
Oh, I see.
Okay. I have my decision. I've thought about it.
Okay.
Here's my thinking. I think it is important that we separate out the health of the relationship. I think that we're combining two things, the health of a relationship and the pain of public humiliation.
Sure.
I think we have to disregard the public humiliation. It is not important. It is not real. It exists nowhere. You can't find it. It has no weight. It has no mass. So my only question is about the health of the relationship. My partner is denying it. And I think that I would have to make a decision to trust that denial, but keep one ear to the ground.
Yeah. Do that thing where your thumb print open their phone as well.
I was not aware of that. Yeah, no, I'm going to just hold the face. Get them
over
get
their face while they're sleeping.
Yeah.
in there. It turns out that they did not cheat on you with that author, but they have cheated on you a ton of other times.
No! Oh my God. Okay, so John, there's always a fucking twist.
I didn't think about it. I didn't know. I didn't know about the twist.
There's always a twist, and it's always devastating.
Devastating.
Fuck,
devastating.
Allison.
Devastating. Well, lesson learned. Lesson learned.
Well, please apply it to this next hypothetical.
Okay.
This one is, are they an alien or just rude? So okay. Like alien from outer space.
Mm-hmm.
The president of the United States announces that they will no longer be meeting with other foreign leaders in person because it's too awkward. Are they an alien or just rude? They are 7 feet tall.
Okay, wait, I'm sorry. What's awkward? Like, what's happening that they're awkward?
They just feel like social anxiety and like they think it's too awkward.
But they managed to become president.
Yes. Well, is that much of a stretch?
Well, yeah. I just think it's a lot of there's a lot of human interaction on the journey to becoming president. Okay, let me ask you this. Mm-hmm. Is it possible that this president was human, but at some point was replaced before making this request?
Did he get it? Stop.
Nailed it. No.
Are you kidding me?
Yes.
No, come on.
Yes. Nailed it. Nailed it.
Someone won hypotheticals?
Boom.
What the fuck?
Yeah. It was a regular human. And no, and what's weird is nobody noticed the president went from 6'10 to 7 feet.
Oh my God.
So proud of myself.
Oh
I'm
my
so
God.
Proud of myself.
I'm so mad.
I mean, in reality, I just liked your answer, so I pretended that's what the answer was the whole time.
I'm so mad.
I think that still counts.
She doesn't have the answers planned. I want you to know she has the hypotheticals written down, but
I feel like you could have. I feel like you didn't need to tell me that. You could have just let me leave here knowing, thinking so highly of myself.
Well, Gabby would have been too upset.
That no, you know what? I
She's too competitive.
I lose every time.
You didn't even guess on the first one.
No, I didn't even. The first one. Oh, I didn't say if I would stay or not. I probably
no, you wanted to just become famous.
Yeah, I think
your answer to every hypothetical.
My answer to every hypothetical is how do I get more famous? And also, yes, I would lie. So go on. Is the last one what I think it is? Is it that game?
No, the last one is, are you a terrible parent?
Oh, okay.
Your 12-year-old child refuses to write a paper for class about what they did over the summer. So you offer to do it for them. You then write 3 pages about your child capturing farts in a jar and then trying to feed the farts to the dog. The teacher has all the children read the papers out loud. Are you a terrible parent? The other kids swap your kid's name for a fart sound for the next 7 years, but they never refuse to do their work again.
So this is to teach them not to ask you to do their work?
Yes.
Wow.
Wow. It's a tough lesson, but one they had to learn.
Well, wow. I mean, look, a lot of ways to teach that lesson. So this is a specific direction. Obviously, a good lesson, right? The lesson is good. Mm-hmm. Do your work. You do your own work. Mm-hmm. Don't ask others to do it. However, suggesting to your child that you will do the work, but then doing the work poorly to prove that lesson feels like a stretch unless I'm missing a twist. And as I've learned, I surely am.
Now, here's my question. How does your child feel about you after that? Are they mad at you? Are they holding a grudge for all the years that they're just called Fart Sound?
Good
like,
question.
Has it ruined your relationship?
Well, Fart Sound at first is very upset.
Is the kid's name Fart Sound now?
Well, the kid's name is
okay.
And so at first, the kid is mad at you, but then they realize that you taught them such an important lesson, and through the resilience they learned after 7 years of intense bullying, they went on to become the president of the United States.
I think you're not a terrible parent. I think you did the right thing.
I think this is terrible parenting. And you know what? That Kennedy dad maybe got those boys to compete and fight. And, you know, JFK got to be president as a result, but it really screwed Teddy up. And I think it screwed the rest of them up, too. And they're still a little bit, they've always struggled. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I think it's not worth it. I think any kind of parenting that leads a child to have a hole in their heart so big, only the presidency can fill it, you know?
Yeah.
So
it's a good point because later an alien takes over their body.
To say.
Somehow I never see the X-Men universe you're building coming.
These are part of the extended universe.
The hypotheticals extended universe.
Rocky Raccoon.
It's very deep. It's
The Mummy.
Mm-hmm.
Batman. One universe.
Yep.
Dracula.
Yep.
Avatar.
It's all
the
one.
Simpsons.
It's all one.
HBO Max.
Actually, this is all just the Avatar
it's
universe.
It's all in the HBO Max universe. The Quibi family. Mrs. Maisel missing an arm. Part of it.
Part of it. She was the mom that wrote the paper, and it's all coming together.
Wow. Thank you so much for joining us. This was amazing.
Thank you for having me.
Where can people find out more about your work?
Well, you can find
just the internet.
The internet, you know, Pod Save America podcast. Love it or leave it. Podcast. You can follow me on Twitter at my name. That's where the content, you can find all the content, you know? Mm-hmm. And that's what life's all about. It's about finding that content and enjoying it, you know?
Yeah. And I was on an episode of Love It or Leave It, so if you want to listen to that,
that's
one,
right,
you're
yeah,
like,
go
wow,
check out,
I love yeah. Gabby.
If you
yeah, go look yeah. at, go start there.
Start with the
See,
with the Gabby Dunn
promoting
episode,
herself
of course.
Yet again.
You have to promote.
You got to look, always be promoting. It is 2020.
Thank you.
If you don't promote you, who will promote you, you know?
Yep. And yeah.
It's very true.
Be the PR person you want to see in the world. You know what I mean?
I not always say that? Thank you. Thank you.
You don't say it quite as eloquently as that, but yes,
not
that
a speechwriter.
Thank you so much, John. This was
this
awesome.
This was great. Thank you so much.
Stick around after the break. We'll be talking all about exposure therapy. Ooh, ah.
A new year, time for new growth. Grow your education and skills with Herzing University. Our online behavioral health programs fit your schedule and time. From an 8-month diploma program in health and human services to a 36-month bachelor's in psychology. Grow your behavioral health career with us wherever you are in your education. Your future starts now at Herzing University. Visit us online at herzing.edu or text health to 85109. Online at herzing.edu or text health to 85109.
Welcome back to Just Between Us. It's time for topics.
XXXXX, baby.
You were a little delayed, so you made up for it with some flair.
Yeah, I mean, what happened was I was like, ugh, do we want to do this every time? And like, how can I make it good every time? But then like, you sing the international question every time, so I don't know why I'm overthinking my part.
No, there's something nice to routine and consistency.
I just thought, oh, God, like midway through, I was like, am I being boring? Which is like me in every situation.
You think that in every situation?
I try to be as interesting as possible, although trying to be interesting is in its own way an oxymoron. So here we are.
Yes. Okay. So we won't dive into that, but
that's for another therapy another session. Okay. Time. Keep going.
So this week, I wanted to talk about exposure therapy.
So you did this for real, 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 realsies. So talk about it.
Exposure therapy is like the basic premise of it is that you are exposing yourself to a stimuli that causes you anxiety or discomfort.
Right.
So it's a super, super effective type of therapy. Especially for people with OCD, and I also think anxiety in general, or phobias. It's super used for phobias. And so, like, an example is, like, when I was a kid, like, I went with my, like, therapist to the Hudson River and, like, put mud on my legs. And, like,
because
that was
to combat
therapy.
OCD.
To combat my, like, contamination, cleanliness, OCD. But then there was stuff right. where, like, I was with my parents and I would drop a stuffed animal and my parents would make me like pick it up and not wash it. And like, that's exposure therapy. Mm-hmm. But there's like a lot of different levels to it. So there's also this thing called systematic desensitization where like you basically like, let's say that you're afraid of bugs, right? Mm-hmm. So you create what's called a fear hierarchy and you would list from least scary to most scary different experiences. So like your least scary experience might be imagining a photo of a bug in your therapist's waiting room, right?
Okay.
Then your second least scary thing would be that magazine is now in the room with you, but it's still just a photo of a bug. Then you like jump ahead and suddenly there's like a bug in the corner. Now there's a bug on your chair. Now there's a bug on you.
Okay.
And so then you create this fear hierarchy with your therapist, and then the therapist teaches you relaxation techniques because the premise is that if you're you can't be both anxious and relaxed at the same time.
Okay.
So
that combats kind of my whole existence, but go on.
So basically, like, you would go through the fear hierarchy either with this example, most likely imaginal. So like your therapist isn't going to actually get a spider, but you're going to be imagining the spider.
Imagining a spider, yeah.
Yeah. But then there's something called in vivo, which is like in real life. And that would be like if they actually did bring a spider in.
Interesting.
So basically, you're tricking your body because you're doing these relaxation techniques between the steps of the fear hierarchy. So you're getting yourself like used to all these different steps. And your body is now used to being calm when those things happen.
Huh. What you're describing is the opposite of conversion therapy, by the way.
I don't know about conversion therapy.
I had to research it for something I was writing, and it's the exact techniques, but used in the opposite way. So it'll be like they'll show you a picture of two girls kissing and then slap you.
Like, that's aversion like, therapy.
Yeah, yeah. It's like it's like the exact opposite of what you're using, but it's the same idea, which is so wild. But like right. what you're doing is like for good versus for evil.
They do aversion therapy for good. So like, you know, if you're an alcoholic, a lot of times there's like elements of aversion therapy there. Mm-hmm. Like with that drug Antibus, is that how you say it? Where like it makes you vomit if you drink. So they'll give you that drug. And then when you drink alcohol, it makes you violently ill.
So then you stop wanting to drink alcohol.
In theory.
To be honest, the first time I had vodka, I was so sick and I threw up. I was a teenager. And now it's like, no vodka for me, please. So just exactly. one bad experience can but really so, stick in your brain.
But so exposure therapy, obviously, like in a therapy setting is great and super helpful and like something that I think I actually should have done a lot more of as a kid. Mm. But there's also just like elements of it that you can do to yourself all the time.
Well, so you were just talking about like if you have social anxiety, going to parties.
Right. So like that's, you should think of that as like exposure therapy, that you're like exposing yourself to something that makes you anxious, but knowing that like the more that you do that, the better it will get. There's also a type of exposure therapy that's pretty controversial called flooding, where you are like, so let's say that like you're afraid again of a bug, and instead of like taking all of these steps, you're like thrown into a room filled with bugs for half an hour.
Oh my like, god,
it's like the thing that you are most afraid of for an extended period of time, with the premise being that like you're incapable of being that heightened in anxiety for forever. So eventually you will calm down.
You tire yourself out. Oh my God, that's so terrifying. Because I could also see where that would make me, because I hate ants. I hate ants so much. I hate mm-hmm. them. They're the worst bug. Fuck you, mm-hmm. ants. And like, to me, I would lose my mind. But like, maybe I would lose my mind so hard that I would come back around to being fine. I don't know.
So sometimes it works, but sometimes it like causes them to be more afraid or like a PTSD Ugh. Experience. So it's, I'm not a big fan of this idea of flooding. I think if you're like in a park and there's an ant, I would like urge you to let it crawl on your hand.
No, this, I can't, I will die. There was one ant in my bed. You should have seen me. I like almost set the entire house on fire. Like I
so
was,
you have a phobia.
I hate them. So like,
yeah. But do you want to live like this or could you get better.
Put one ant on my hand and see what happens.
Yeah. Or honestly, you can start even smaller. You can just start with someone else holding an ant near you.
Looking at a picture of an ant.
Yeah. Because that's another way. It's like, it's called modeling. So like I would do the thing that you're afraid of and then you would see like, oh, I'm actually okay.
Are you okay though? Are
you? I can hold an ant.
I know, but I would... Because the idea is you do it and you don't die and everything's fine.
Yeah, it's like you're having an irrational reaction to something.
Right.
You're having a fear response when you're not actually in danger.
I see. Yeah, but what if I hold it and that's the one time an ant kills someone?
That's not a thing that happens.
I guess you can get killed by many ants, but one ant you wouldn't get killed by, right?
Correct.
Ugh, I hate them so much.
I think it's really cool because obviously it's best done under the supervision of a therapist, but it's also just like these little challenges that you can give yourself all of the time. Mm-hmm. So like getting sugar for me was exposure therapy because I was so afraid of contamination Mess. And outside yeah. and outside germs and like the fact that like she walks on the ground and everything. And so mm-hmm. I had like a somewhat long transition with her where like at the beginning I was fine with her in my house if I'd wipe down her paws and butt, right? Mm-hmm. But then if I like went out with her and she would try to like sit on my lap and I hadn't wiped down her paws and butt, that was really hard for me. And maybe I like wouldn't let her do it, or I would like go to a bathroom to wipe her down. And then I settled, and then like eventually I got to a place where I can go out with her and like I will let her sit on me even if I haven't wiped her paws and butt.
It was like over time.
Yeah.
So you kind of can do it like, right, like going to parties, like go to this party and like say, I'm going to stay for an hour.
Yeah.
And then like you're kind of doing it yourself, or like go to this party and talk to one new person. Mm-hmm. And then you achieve it. And you're like, I talked to one new person. It doesn't have to be a good interaction.
Exactly.
You just have to be like, you know what? I'm okay with however this turns out.
Yeah, I think it's a really great, I think it's a really great way to reframe social interactions if you have social anxiety, where it's like you realize that like every time you go and do that and you force yourself to interact, like you're actually like you're helping yourself. You're therapizing yourself in that moment.
And like, it can be hard because people are like, I just have this thing, leave me alone. You know what I mean? Like they're like,
that's what you said to me a minute ago about ants.
Why are you forcing me? But it's also like, it would be like, ants are everywhere. Like it would be good for me to not like see an ant and want to throw up. But like,
yeah, that sucks. It sucks to be that irrationally afraid of something that you're going to interact with a lot.
Yeah.
And like knowing that like this is a proven thing that works, I think is so empowering. That like knowing that eventually if you let that ant be on your hand long enough, you will be okay.
Yeah, and if it doesn't work right away, it's not that it's not working or you failed. It's like the idea is that it's repetitive, repetitive, repetitive.
Absolutely.
You know what's interesting is you can apply this to polyamory too. Because I think sometimes you're like catastrophizing and it's like the worst case scenario. Oh my God, my partner like could like flirt with someone else. I'm freaking out. But if you like, they do flirt with someone else and they stay with you and everything's fine. And it's, then you're like, oh, and then the next time they kiss someone else and you're like, okay. And like, it doesn't have to jump right into like, they're fucking other people. Mm-hmm. Like a lot of times it's like you're using like small bits of exposure therapy in order to like open up a relationship. My relationship with my parents too. You do it in small doses.
But so then let's say something like flying, if you're afraid of flying. Mm-hmm. They now have like these virtual reality treatments.
What?
Yeah, so there's a lot of now like exposure therapy through VR.
So it'll like you'll pretend you're on an airplane.
Mm-hmm.
And they just have like, the flight goes well. Like in the simulation.
But like, you know, because it's a little harder to like, your therapist isn't like gonna get on a plane with you and like take off, you know, like but like through these VR experiments, like you can be on an airplane, you could be in a field filled with dogs if you're afraid of dogs. Like, you know, like I think it's also a really good thing to know if you have young kids, because a lot of phobias come up around like 7 or 8. Mm. And so like knowing that like it's not going to fuck up your kid if they're afraid of dogs to expose them to dogs, it's actually like way better to actually expose them to the dog. Mm-hmm. And like you can do that in steps. Like you don't go, okay, I'm going to put you on this dog's back. But like,
right.
You know, maybe your friend who has a dog, you agree to like meet in a park together and the kid won't be anywhere near the dog, but the dog will be there.
Yeah.
You know, and the next time the dog is like off leash. So it's not next to the kid, but it's a little closer. And then the next time the kid pets, you know, like it's better to push your kid through these phobias than to just like work around it so your kid never sees a dog.
Well, that's the thing, right? Because I think the instinct is to enable. The instinct is like, I don't want to upset this person or my kid or my friend or my partner or whatever. So I'm going to work around it. But like if your parents had worked around your OCD, that they would have enabled it to get worse.
Oh, absolutely. I wouldn't have like left my room.
Right.
Like, I wouldn't have been able to function.
Well, Cheyenne had a lot of behavioral issues. And like a lot of times my parents were just like, it's not worth it to fight with her. But like, I think it would have benefited both of us if like they had, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, they did a lot of times. And let me tell you, Cheyenne's a tough one. Like nobody, if you can avoid fighting with her, you do.
But that's her conditioning you. So that's
the thing.
She knows that if she acts like that, then people will leave her alone.
Yep.
So then she keeps acting like that.
Yep. So that's the thing. Like if it's your kid, it's hard to say to someone like, with a difficult kid that doesn't want to do anything, it's hard to be like, no, you have to force them, because it's like, oh, what an ordeal, and it's exhausting. But like, you kind of have to.
Yeah. And people don't like people who don't like dogs.
Yep. Yeah, and it's a lot.
But even just like the fact that you're walking through life so afraid of this insect that is everywhere.
I hate him.
But like,
I hate him.
Let's work on it.
You know what my big fear is?
What?
That there's an ant in my hair and I don't know.
And what would that mean?
That there's an ant in my hair and I didn't know about it.
And why is that so bad?
Right. I don't know why, but I don't like it. It makes me upset.
But why?
Cause it got on me, and I don't know when it got on me and it tricked me. I don't know. What if it bites me or something?
Okay.
The reason I don't like ants is because with a bigger bug, like a tarantula, you would see it. You would feel it on you and you would see it. But an ant could have been there for hours. You would never even know.
And what is it doing? It's just sitting there.
Gross.
But then when you take the ant off of your head, you're back to normal. Nothing has changed. The ant hasn't hurt you.
Yeah, I don't know. It seems...
But do you see how like exposure therapy could help you through this?
Yes, exactly, because nothing's going to happen.
Right. So once you have had the ant on your head for 10 minutes and it's your worst fear, and then you're like, oh, okay, I had an ant on my head. Who cares?
I'll think about it. The next time
for
I see
our
an
100th
ant,
episode, Gabby will record the whole thing with an ant on her head.
Yeah, for our 100th episode, I will touch an ant. How about that? I will touch an ant. You know, people have like ant farms in their houses. Those people are insane. Yes.
This is your phobia.
No. I'm right. Having an ant farm means something is wrong with you.
Oh my God. We got a lot of work to do off this podcast. All right, Tamika, come on in and share your phobias.
Tamika, if you have an ant farm, you're fired.
You do not have the power to fire her.
What's your phobia?
I don't know if this counts, but like, first dates are terrifying for me. Mm-hmm. I like will get physical anxiety thinking about going on a first date.
So what would be great for you would be to have like 5 first dates in 1 week. And just like boom, 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 boom.
That's the equivalent of Gabby's reaction to like staring at an ant. It sounds awful.
Tamika, I'll go on 5 dates for you if you touch one ant.
Oh my gosh, I would do that in a heartbeat.
I would also do that in a heartbeat.
Hey, this is why it feels like a therapy session. It's like Allison's giving us great therapy advice. I deal with our phobias.
Yeah,
but I think it's just so freeing. As someone who's been so afraid of so many things, like, and I continue to be, but like every time I can knock one off the list, it's such a relief.
Mm.
So I want that relief for you guys as well.
Well, that's sweet.
Yeah. And listeners couldn't see this, but like during the session I was watching on Zoom, Allison had like one fist on her chin, just like giving Gabby the best therapy advice. It was very, very professional.
And I was making faces like, no. Well, you should go on a bunch of first dates because like, okay, what's the worst thing that happens? They're bad? Okay.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, you have no fear when it comes to romance. And I probably have more social anxiety than you too. So it's a combination of like social anxiety and fear of rejection, which I think you don't have romantically. So yeah, it just sounds like the worst experience I could ever have doing like 5 first dates in a week.
But by 5, by date 5, it won't, you just like, your body will be like too physically exhausted to like make it as big of a deal as date 1 was.
Exactly.
Hmm.
And then with the rejection thing, you have to just like go down the logic trail of like, okay, so this person rejected me. What does that mean?
Oh,
one person out of like millions of people, billions of people didn't want to go on a second date with me.
But it's not even just being rejected. It's having to reject someone else.
Mm-hmm.
That's also a lot of pressure. Like, I hate hurting people's feelings.
But then you have to say, okay, I'm one person in a billions of people who's, you know, like, who am I to be so important to this person that I'm going to ruin their lives because I don't want to go on a second date with them. Mm. I think now would be a great time for you to be on dating apps and just to be talking to as many people at once. And I think it will, like, I think that would be good exposure therapy for you during this pandemic.
Probably.
Because it's very low stakes. You don't have to actually meet them, but you could just get used to, like, the dating app banter and talking to people and, you know, figuring out when you want to stop talking to someone, when you do want to, like, give them your actual phone number, maybe actually FaceTime. Like, I think this could be a really cool, fun, interesting time for you.
You are going to be a great therapist.
No pressure to meet up.
Exactly.
That's true.
Okay.
You know, since Gabby looked at a picture of an ant, I will get on one dating app.
Woo!
I think that's a fair trade.
I love
Yay!
That.
Yay! In lieu of a traditional show rating, we just wanted to say, you want to take it away, Allison?
Fuck the police. Black Lives Matter. And stay safe out there, guys.
Oh, wow. I didn't know what you were going to say, but I'm very into it. And check our show notes for resources.
Yes.
Okay. Love you guys.
Love you guys. Thank you so much to John Lovett for being our guest. Just Between Us is hosted by me, Allison Raskin.
And me, Gabby Dunn.
Our engineer is Brendan Burns. He also composed our killer theme music.
Our producer is Tamika Weatherspoon, and our supervising producer is Josephine Martirano.
Our executive producer is Chris Bannon.
Just Between Us is a production of Stitcher.
So I'm going to need to see some screenshots, Tamika.
Stitcher.